Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, we're going to have one of our occasional conversations about our mutual home state, California. You still live there, of course. I don't, which is occasionally a cause of sorrow for me. And then I read one of your columns, and it just flushes that romanticism straight out of my system. The one that precipitates our conversation today, you wrote for National Review, and it's entitled America's First Third World State. Now, I've read the piece. I lived in the state. I know exactly where you're coming from here, but let me play devil's advocate on behalf of the people who have had neither of those experiences and are just hearing this title and are maybe saying them to themselves, are you telling me that of all 50 states, you're saying that the one with Palo Alto and La Jolla and Malibu and Tahoe, or at least half of Tahoe and Napa Valley, you're telling me that this cradle of wealth and innovation is third world? How can that be? How would you respond to that?
Well, I think we had this conversation 5 years ago when I wrote an article called The Other California, and the argument I used then was one-third of the nation's welfare recipients, 22% of the state population below the poverty line, 27% of the population born in a foreign country, highest array of taxes and lowest achieving schools or worst rated infrastructure, I think, except for Mississippi. And my argument then was, well, what you describe, that paradox, is a phenomenon of coastal culture that's affluent, most billionaires of any state, highest per capita counties in income versus the interior. But I'm not sure that that exegesis works anymore because it's been 5 years. And I think what I was talking about, if you're looking for outbreaks of typhus or infectious hepatitis or tuberculosis, you actually find them in cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco and San Jose. And if you're looking at power outages or threatened power outages or announcement from Pacific Gas and Electric, the public utility that, by the way, has declared bankruptcy, that it won't be able to service its customers for a variety of reasons, that's in the coast as well, the affluent sectors that you detailed. And when you look at housing, I live in Fresno, southern Fresno County, which is officially the second poorest part of California, and its per capita income is about $13,000 a year, like Appalachia. But when I go into my hometown, I don't see the streets lined with buses where people are living. When I go to work in Palo Alto, San Mateo County, I think the per capita income is about $130,000, 10 times higher. I see along El Camino Real in front of Stanford University these huge Winnebagos and buses where people, I guess, are renting beds because they come in and out of them all day long. And they sort of park there, then they move. And my point is that homelessness, which is a third world phenomenon, is pretty prevalent on the coast, the wealthy California, not just the other California. So my point in the article was, by any barometer of medieval diseases or the inability to keep electricity on in a reliable fashion or the necessity of thousands of people, we have half the nation's homeless in California, about 300,000 people, to go live on the street or live in their cars. That's in California throughout the state. And that's pretty scary. When I look at, I just got back from Greece, and that kind of prompted the article because the Greek freeways, when I lived there in the 70s and the 80s, were pretty pre-modern. But now they're Swiss and German-built autobahns, and they're wonderful. They tunnel right through mountains. And that I first got there in 1973, and at that point, California's freeways looked like Greece's do now. Now, our freeways looked like Greece's of 1973. I just drove 5 hours up to Northern California, and it was almost like Odysseus trying to get home. There was all sorts of, you know, there was cyclopses and sirens and everything. But the point I'm making, it was pretty hazardous. And
this is one of the points I wanted to raise with you, because there are about 40 million people in California. So that works out to basically one in every eight Americans living in the state. And I remember you saying on one of our episodes years ago one of the paradoxes of California is that it attracts all these people, yet the state government seems intent to make it unlivable for a population that size, that they do business as if they'd be satisfied with a cap of about 20 million. And one of your big arguments in this piece, and ironically, this is how post-war Democrats like Pat Brown used to think about California, is that one of its core needs, one of the key ingredients to any future success, is better infrastructure. So explain, you've already explained that a little as regards to the roads, but just tease that argument out for us and what the consequences have been of the failure to do that.
Well, the way California works is it has three north-south, and it's a north-south state. It's much longer than it is wider, and it has three major freeways, the 101 on the coast, and then the 99 in the east, and the 5 in the interior. They overlap in places, but they were originally pretty good freeways. They had, when we had 17, 18 million people, they had four lanes. And a large part of 99 is still four lanes. All of I-5 is outside of Los Angeles, four lanes. And outside the metropolitan areas, 101 is still four lanes. So my point is that you added 20 people without changing the infrastructure. Were we talking in 1971 about the California Water Project and the Central Valley Project, we would say that they were the most sophisticated water transfers, engineering products in the history of civilization. If you look at the California Aqueduct, it was brilliant. But it was never designed without its logical expansion and adaptation of the tertiary, the third-level dams, to suffice for a 40 million person California. So we go from 1 year existential drought where lawns die, people are on rationing, they don't bathe until the next year where we've got so much water, we're letting 50 million acre feet out in the San Francisco Bay because we have nowhere to put it because we never expanded or finished the system. And so we are living in a third world infrastructure. And boy, when I go into Palo Alto and I drive by the neighborhoods where I'm told the Google and Apple and Facebook executives live, I see all these Atherton and Menlo Park, Woodside and Portola Valley zillionaires' gated homes, but the roads are just despicable. They're potholed, they're dirty. When I walk down University Avenue, it's full of homeless people. And I can drive in places in Stanford where I'll see islands that have trees and grass where there'll be homeless people camping in there. And so it is a third world country, and that third worldism has gone, as I said earlier, to the other California, and it's a product of sort of California's infrastructure is stuck in amber while we have 20 million more people. And it's not just 20 million more third-generation Californians of all cultures and background. It's, to a large extent, 27% of the population wasn't born in California. That means we have a lot of people that we need to acculturate and make sure they know English, they understand the basics of American citizenship. Many of them are from Asia and many more from Central America and Mexico. Many of them come without legality. They don't come in measured fashion. They don't come with meritocratic skills. They don't come with a diploma or English. And they don't even come with legality. And you put all of that into the mixture in a hyper-progressive state that is given up hope on the melting pot and adopted identity politics, sanctuary cities, the salad bowl, then you've got I should say you have the ingredients for California that we never envisioned under Pat Brown. It's the front line of this immigration challenge for California. So by that I mean that's where people who are not equipped with a birth certificate or they're here illegally, they go to get something they need to operate, a car. And because I'll give you one example. The federal government after 9/11 said within a finite time, any state that allowed people to have an alternate license without ID requirements, i.e. illegal aliens, then would have to have a real ID. So we now are telling Californians, like other states, come next fall, if you don't have a real ID, you cannot fly. Translated, that means, say, at the Fresno airport that has three flights a day to Guadalajara, Mexico, and they're always packed, these people who are flying are, for the most part, not U.S. citizens, and most of them are here illegally. So they need to get on that plane, and they don't have passports. So they go to the DMV, and they say, well, I need to get my real ID. Well, the DMV says, the federal law says you have to have a birth certificate, which many of them don't have, or you have to have a passport, which none of them have, and then you have to have two proof of residencies, a power bill or a phone bill, and then you have to have a Social Security number, which most of them don't have. So how are they going to get a real ID that distinguishes them from a regular California license, which distinguishes them from a license granted to people that are here illegally? And the answer is, as I found out when I made an appointment and then left 2 hours later, is that a lot of people just take pictures of stuff. In other words, they'll get a birth certificate from someone else, cut and paste, put a piece of their name on it, or they will get their residence, and or they'll get a W-2 and change the Social Security number and take a picture of it, or Xerox it. And then they go to the DMV and they're told, no, that's not going to work. You have to have the original copy. And then people say, well, that's not fair. Then the person at the window says, let me go get my supervisor. And most of it is conducted in Spanish. And you can imagine when it's 105 degrees in Hanford or Reedley, and that same office is swamped because it's giving licenses, their old licenses, to illegal aliens first, because to get a real ID, you need a prior California license. So you can imagine what that does. And when you compound the fact that the Democratic Party, the Progressive Movement, sees the DMV as a way of registering people to vote, even though the people who are on their license rolls are illegal and they're supposed to distinguish illegals who have driver's license from legals. And we're told that, at least in the case of 70,000 in the last election, they were accidentally on purpose conflated, and we had to fire the DMV director, apparently. And now there's reports that maybe 1 million people voted in congressional districts that were not registered to vote in those districts. You can see what's going on in California. I guess the best way to sum it up would be, any means necessary or justified for the superior, virtuous goal of bringing in thousands of very poor people and offering them parity in the American dream. And because that's so noble, we don't really care about the means necessary to pull it off. That would be the best take on it. The worst take on it would be, we want to make sure that there's less than 7 congressional of 53 congressional districts that are Republican. We got rid of 8 of them. Let's get rid of all of them next time. And we don't have one state official who's Republican. And we have a supermajority in the House and the Assembly, I should say, in the state Senate. And this is a good model. And maybe Nevada and Colorado and New Mexico and Arizona and Texas can follow it. And therefore, this chaos that I describe at the DMV is not seen as chaos. It's seen as a kind of inconvenient but otherwise commendable way of bringing a lot of people across the border that are going to change the demographics of the Electoral College in a positive way for those in power.
I'd also note your observation in the National Review piece where you say that there is one pretty functional branch of the DMV in the state, and it's a, as you render it, a sort of quasi-secret location in Sacramento that's just available for legislators.
I found that out by talking to a legislator who kind of winked and nodded and said that he just goes to this private little place and he doesn't stand in line, because I was whining to him about, I wish you had to stay. And then I looked it up when I got home, and there's actually a story in the Sacramento Bee that it does exist, and people are outraged about its existence.
you mentioned earlier, and you've mentioned in past episodes, the sort of the cultural contrast that you see if you head the car north from the Central Valley up to Silicon Valley or south down to Los Angeles. And there has been, especially in the past decade or so, a growing argument that California is so immense. You've got a huge population. The state's the size of Germany. there's arguably, because this is more an art than a science, somewhere between a half dozen and a dozen kind of distinct regions. And the argument runs that this is a society that is simply too complex and too diverse to wrangle into one state. And so we've seen increasingly dramatic reform proposals, people talking about breaking it up into smaller states, or people talking about writing a new constitution. Are you to that point where it seems like absent some big fundamental institutional change, this is not going to get any better?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to get better in my lifetime. My hope would always be that in the matter, say, of illegal immigration, that the Hispanic model is sort of emulating the Latino, the Italian-American model of the early 20th century. But that was predicated on abbreviated immigration spurts, not continuous ones. My point is, for assimilation and integration and intermarriage to work, you can't have a million people coming across the border illegally and without a high school diploma or English. Just too much. It taxes the powers of assimilation to so much that it doesn't work. But so I'm not very confident. If you were to split the state in two, I think there would be a more conservative, mostly Latino state in the middle, i.e. from Bakersfield to Sacramento, and you would combine the Sierra Nevada, which is very conservative, and maybe all the way in the west side up to the foothills. It wouldn't be nearly as rich as the coast. It wouldn't have Stanford or Caltech. It wouldn't have Apple or Google, etc. But you would not be passing legislation about transgendered restrooms or straws to be banned or against the law to have your dog chase a bobcat. It would be more elemental stuff. The power is too high. The gas is too high. There's not enough housing. We got to build better roads. It'd be much more pragmatic. And that might be good, I think. What we're doing now in California, we're telling the minority population, we give you guys open borders, and we give you guys plentiful, unaudited social programs and entitlements, and we protect your relatives, friends, family members from deportation when they're residing illegally through our sanctuary city program. And therefore, your representatives have to get on board with us in not building affordable housing, regulating gas and oil out of existence, shutting down the timber and mining industries, and having these boutique green issues. That's what you signed up for. It's a very condescending attitude. And somehow that nexus has to be broken, and I don't know how it will be, because as soon as a moderate or conservative legislator who self-identifies as Latino says something, they feel that he's in an ingrate, or he's not following the party line. But until we have a viable conservative or centrist Latino political movement, we're not going to see much change, simply because about 40% of the population now self-identifies as Latino. And of that, probably 70% of them are Democratic voters.
So, final question. You've had a tremendous amount of success in your career. You've distinguished yourself as a scholar. You've distinguished yourself as a public intellectual. All that to say, you're not someone who's caught in a mobility trap where you can't just pick up stakes and leave. And I venture to say that if Victor Davis Hanson announces tomorrow that he's relocating to Texas, there's a welcome party waiting for him at the border. But for all these hardships, for all these...
Oh, you mean the California border?
for all of these frustrations, you remain Victor Davis Hanson of Selma, California. Why?
You know, it's funny. That's a topic of conversation that my wife and I have, because we live in this 3,000 square foot Victorian farmhouse that was built in 1870 with a 3-acre yard. And then we have 45 acres of farmland. And I'm 65 and she's 56. So we're not as young and spry. So we don't have any help at all. I mean, I do all the yard work and all the maintenance, and she does all the interior cleaning and cooking. And she works full time as a professor, and I work full time as well. So we're saying maybe we should relocate, and then we start talking. And I don't think either of my surviving children want to live here for a variety of reasons. They marry other people from different areas of California. They're not attached to the Central Valley to the same degree. So we ask ourselves, why are we doing this? And I guess the answer comes that a couple of things. One is I don't want to be the first in six generations to sell something, that, and I want to give my children the chance to make that decision the way I had that chance. And so my great-great-grandmother built this house, and I see pictures of her every day. I'm looking at one right now. So it's kind of lethargy or traditions. The other thing is that I've found a way to insulate myself from the things that you and I have talked about over the years. And by that, I mean, I kind of feel this is like a small little farmhouse in North Africa about 500 AD when the Vandals came. And by that, I mean, there's a lot of people that I went to high school with that are Mexican-American and who are my closest friends. And they're all politically centrist or conservative. And if anything, they're more conservative about the border than I am. I saw one. I had dinner last night with one that I went to first grade with. And they have the same concerns that I do. And then two, I kind of know the sheriffs. I know some of the larger farm families. I built about 20 years ago, I built a 600-foot stone wall around the whole compound. And within it, I tried to make kind of a Greek garden. So I have a pool and beautiful yard, and I have this 6-foot-and-a-half wall. So when I walk out of the wall, I'm out in the real world where my neighbors are engaging in chop shops and shootouts and cockfights and illegal activity. And we have a lot of... But within my compound, if you have five of these Australian cattle dogs, Queensland heelers, and you're pretty safe. And I mean that literally, because what's one of the shocking things about it is I live in one of the highest crime rates. I think Fresno is one of the highest, except maybe for San Francisco, property crime rate areas per capita. But when I talk to people who are very wealthy that live on the San Joaquin River and places like Stockton or Fresno, very affluent areas, or I talk to my daughter who lives in Santa Cruz, or I talk to even people in Palo Alto, I hear these horrendous stories of break-ins and vandalism. I've never had any of that in the last 10 or 15 years. And I don't know whether that's because the local sheriffs like to do their paperwork in my yard, or I'm on good terms with a lot of people. But so far, the last time we had a serious break-in, I think it was 15 years ago. It was pretty scary, but I haven't had that lately. But otherwise, you know, just not to ramble too much, but
there is an advantage. I don't socialize with other Hoover scholars because I'm here, you know, when I go to Stanford, I'm working all day from 6 to 8 in my office to get all my business done. And then when I'm here, nobody ever comes over to my house. We don't go out to dinner with other couples, so I get a lot of work done. But, you know, it's 106 today here. And I'm going to hang up and try to go up on the roof and figure out what in the world is wrong with my used internet. And my landline is out, as usual, when it gets hot. And I'd much rather be at Stanford today or up in the mountains. So I don't know how long this is going to last, but I guess the final answer is I just don't want to be the first link in a chain that broke. And I have some confidence that things are going to change. And I really don't believe that what a person's ethnic background or color or whatever the superficial identity politics stuff is matters at all. I have no problem with the fact that my community used to be, when I first was born into it, about 75% Scandinavian. This was a Danish town. Kingsburg next door was a Swedish. And now it's about 90% Hispanic. I think that's great. My only worry is that I'd like the culture to remain the same. And by that I mean honest government and efficient government. And I have some confidence that second and third generation Mexican-American former immigrants follow in that tradition, and that they too are not tribal as we think they are when we read about the left wing of the Democratic Party.
And so that's my hope, but we'll see what happens.
I could be shot tomorrow by a guy stripping a semi in my yard, or I could walk out my house literally to get the mail and a stray dog could bite me and I'd have another decision, as I've had two or three times, whether to get rabies shots or not. But right now, I think that's the reason I stay.
Well, we'll choose, as I'm sure our listeners will, to embrace the more optimistic of the two forecasts. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy the Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.